This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Abigail Tucker, who I think it's okay to call you Abby, who's the author of The Lion in the Living Room, which is a really cool book. It's called How House Cats Tamed Us and Took Over the World. How are you, Abby?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me, David.
Yeah, it's really fun to talk to you about this book. I will preface by telling you that I am not your audience. I'm not a cat person, although maybe your audience includes people who are simply interested in the phenomenon of cat-loving insanity, which, you know, you document pretty well. And I'm really curious... what got you, I kind of know from the book, but I mean, maybe you should talk a little bit about why you chose to write this book.
Well, I chose to write the book because I'm from the opposite school. I've always had cats, and my mother always had cats. Her mother always had cats. We're just from a cat-loving family. But I guess I never understood why we had these animals around. They were such a important part of our lives, and they were so close to me growing up that I was never able to really see them in an objective way. But later on, as I became a journalist, and particularly a journalist who specialized in writing about animals, I started to question their presence in my life personally, and then also sort of in the culture at large. And especially since, as a wildlife writer, I'd done some pieces on cats, closely related to house cats, other members of the feline family, and found that these animals are so often in dire straits in terms of the habitat that they're losing and their conflicts with man generally. It sort of made even less sense that this little member of the cat family that looked so much and acted so much like these other bigger members of the cat family was having such an epic success story when pretty much all of the rest of the cat family is falling on hard times in the 21st century.
Well, and I think, you know, I was interested because you are a science writer and you come to this with a science background, but you know, I think you're kind of the attitude of the book is one of sort of mystification, you know, like you're addressing that question of the strangeness of cats being so familial in our society because they, and I learned quite a bit from you in terms of the biology of cats. You know, we sort of think, we recognize that they're, you know, predators, but the, it is this really interesting incongruency that you have a tamed predator essentially in people's homes, and that these are they're not that different from wild felines, and as you talked about just now, you alluded to they you know, in the wild they need a tremendous amount of space to hunt from because they eat so much protein.
Exactly. Yeah, cats are what's called hypercarnivores, so they are requiring something like more than 70% of their diet is protein and meat, and they need huge areas of space to harvest this protein from, and that's sort of one of the reasons that they tend to butt heads with men a lot, because we fight over this very valuable resource, meat. So that's one reason why you hear these terrible things about the lion population in Africa plummeting and the tiger population in Asia plummeting, and even the smaller species of cats that aren't directly a threat to people, they just come into conflict with us so much because of this intense protein requirement that they have. And there's really no way around it. And our cats that we feed from a can are just the same. They require this extremely demanding diet of meat, which is very precious.
No, that's true. I mean, and kind of ecologically, keeping house cats is kind of a negative. I don't think you really talk about that much in the book. I don't think you're trying to, you know, make any, you're not trying to teach anybody. Well, you're not trying to preach is what I would say. But there is that issue that you kind of allude to, and that is that, you know, there's an argument about whether eating meat in a world, you know, in a time of high population and diminishing natural resources, you know, with meat is an inefficient way for people to get protein. And obviously, as we, you know, harvest more meat to feed cats who are pets that are not necessary for our life, you know, I guess maybe others would argue about that point, but that you know, there, I mean, there is a kind of, you know, there's an ecological argument for vegetarianism, and there is a corollary that follows that argument that applies to meat eating pets.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One of the things that I was sort of puzzled by when I was writing the book, I had the opportunity to go to some conventions of people who are involved in the world of feral cat care and taking care of stray cats and things along these lines. And they tend to be just extremely compassionate, devoted animal lovers. And for that reason, this conference that I went to was not just vegetarian, it was vegan. I looked for milk for my coffee when I was there, and I only found soy milk. And so there's this devotion to this idea that we, you know, we should not kill animals. But of course, it was a convention for the protection of stray cats. And as you say, they are, you know, a predator that you know, needs all this meat and doesn't necessarily belong in the numbers that it's in our environment. And so it was a vegan convention in support of a hyper carnivore, which I thought was really kind of curious.
It is. Well, I think you come across in this book many oddities, many strangenesses, and I thought you handled that very well without, you know, without kind of, again, without preachiness or without kind of holding people up to, you know, ridicule that you might have done. But, oh, you know, you allow the reader to make her or his own judgments, I think. I thought there were just some amazing things. There was actually one, for some reason, there was so many things in this one chapter that I found really, really interesting. And one of the chapters, which has a great title, I think, Pandora's Litter Box. Just, I love that title. And I, you know, I made marks in the book about, you know, things I wanted to talk about. And this chapter is full of things. And this is where you went to the Global Pet Expo. And I had just, it happens that I was in that building for the American Library Association had its meeting in the Orlando Convention Center. So I know how big that is. It's a massive, massive building. And it's just some of the things you talked about there are amazing. And of course, the history of cats being domesticated. And I that was interesting to me too, that I did not realize that Carl Van Vechten had written a treatise on house cats, which I thought was pretty cool. He's a really interesting writer. And the idea that cats have become indoor animals, indoor pets, is really fairly recent, you know, as a development that even though we kept cats, people kept cats as pets, they were not necessarily house cats. And I thought that was an interesting subject, you know, it's just sort of the evolution of how things have changed so rapidly in our modern world. You know, there's so many things that have changed, but that's a recent phenomenon.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was kind of stunned to learn that up until the 60s, people were spending more money on pet bird paraphernalia than on cat stuff. I mean, it's been that recent of a change. And I think that there's different reasons why cats have a greater claim on the 21st century than they do previous centuries. And, you know, one thing has to do with just the way that modern life is structured and the phenomenon of urbanization. Everybody moving in from rural areas means that living with dogs isn't as easy as it once was. And even things like the rise of the dual income household have made having dogs that need to be taken out in the middle of the day and things like that have made it tougher. And so there's this phenomenon of this, you know, countries, cat populations growing by leaps and bounds. And that's, you know, the animals that we keep inside our homes, often sort of hermetically sealed inside of our houses. But then some of them kind of slip out. And there are these parallel populations of stray cats, which are living in kind of the shadows of these metropolises that we've built. And they're really interesting, too. So it's both this life of these still kind of only half domesticated animals that find themselves suddenly locked in our apartments, and then their brethren who are living outside and who are able to sort of draw from their domesticated physiques to excel in urban environments, and then even in wildernesses when they reach those areas too. It's just this fascinating story of global spread, and at the heart of it is this idea that the cat is this marvelous animal that is adaptable in so many different situations, and can, even though it requires meat, it can eat many, many different kinds of animals. It can change its social life and even its diurnal rhythms to get along in different places. And, you know, it's just an animal that can breed at staggering rates and is just getting along like gangbusters in the 21st century, when so many animals, especially animals with meat heavy diets, are in deep trouble.
Right. But of course, that has, as we, you know, as you talk about, has in a couple of situations has corollary negative values, that, you know, the cats eat a lot of wild birds. They eat, you know, they just, they're, you know, when they are in, they can be an invasive species on their own. Almost impossible to prevent them from taking over an ecosystem, which is just frightening.
Yeah, they, once they get their claws into an ecosystem, they are pretty tough to dislodge. And, you know, there's some governments across the world, but especially in Australia, which are grappling with how to get these animals out of their, you know, they can live anywhere from tropical forests to desert, basically, or to you know, almost in subarctic conditions. And they're particularly dangerous in places like Australia and New Zealand, where cats, the feline family, isn't native to those areas. So the animals that live there are just completely unprepared for a feline predator. But even in mainland America, you know, there's been an outcry about the damage that these animals, which, you know, as we say, are kind of, they're in a way a luxury good. We don't need them for anything. We just happen to love them. They cause harm to a lot of different kinds of animals, and it's tough to quantify exactly how many they kill, but, you know, billions seems to be the verdict that we get from the bird scientists who study this question. A lot of killing.
Yeah, no, there's a real tension between the people who are bird lovers, Audubon Society people, and the cat fancy people. There's a real conflict.
Oh, yeah.
There. It is not something that's solvable by compromise.
Yes, it's definitely a minefield. And I think the interesting thing about it is that on both sides, we have these ardent animal lovers and people who just want the best for animals and for the world. But it's just very different alliances. And this is a conflict that is raging right now, but it goes back at least 100 years. I mean, it's something that has always been brewing, but, you know, back, you know, in the early 1900s, birds were, first of all, they had more of a claim on our affections. They were more popular even than dogs as household pets. People just loved to have caged birds around, and it was a huge global trade. But so birds were more popular, and cats were present and were affiliated with us. But the practice of formal pet keeping and keeping cats inside of our houses or letting our cats out in the yard, they weren't, it wasn't as widespread a practice, and the population spike in cats hadn't happened yet. So basically, this is a conflict that's been ongoing, but the recent jump in numbers of cats and the sort of glorification of cats in the culture generally online and stuff, that's, I think, contributing to why we hear so much about this cat versus bird thing these days.
Well, and there are, as you said, you know, in very recent years, there do seem to be more people more committed to cat loving and cat kind of domination of culture than we, you know, even imaginably 20 or 30 years ago, when, you know, if you think about pets, dogs were much more predominant. You know, I can't think of a cat that has, well, actually there probably are some, but in the older day, like Rin Tin Tin or Lassie, you know, those are the dog, you know, they were dogs that were part of human lore and culture. More so than cats were. Now you do have cat, Tom and Jerry, I guess. So there, you know, it's not completely foreign, but it does seem that cats have risen in the last few years. You know, maybe, and there's this idea that cat pheromones, you know, are powerful. And that when people are near cats, they become kind of chemically imbalanced, you know, and that they love cats inordinately.
This idea of you know, how disturbingly widespread toxoplasmosis, the parasite that you get from cat droppings, and that ultimately is known to invade the brain tissue of many mammals, including humans. Something like, you know, 1 in 3 people on the planet has this parasite, and you know, I think it's something like 1 in 10 Americans, really staggering numbers of people are infected. And there's this argument that, hey, maybe it's this hidden parasite which is puppeteering us and making us adore cats to this extent. But I also think that the argument works the other way. It's like, we're so fascinated with this parasite because maybe it helps to explain this fascination that we have and share but don't quite understand. And I actually, in the book, talk a little bit about how I see this as a modern version of a witch scare. Like, back in the day, people used to associate cats with the occult and demonic mischief and all this stuff. And it was in part because they didn't really understand their relationship to these animals or why on earth we have them around, let alone in such numbers. And I think that these are just kind of not totally successful attempts to explain away this growing craze that we see around us. And, you know, I think it's just got so many different legs to it, basically. And it's just hard to think of a circumstance where such a craze could arise again like this. But, you know, of course, in the past, there have been, I do talk about how there have been a few other instances of cat madness. And in Japan, post-war Japan, you had the rise of Hello Kitty, which is still going on and still kind of an interesting parallel. And of course, there's late ancient Egypt, where cats became a pseudo-religion in a way.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, maybe there is something to this idea that cats have some mysterious power, and but it also, another thing you brought up, which I thought was interesting, and that is this idea or this phenomenon of cat illness based on kind of being tamed, you know, that they're, because it, they spend so much time indoors or whatever it may be. You know, you talk about what it sounds a lot like, this biological stress notion of overpopulation, you know, that people who have studied rats have noticed that when you've got, you know, because rats do populate in, at an incredible rate, similar to cats, once there are too many rats in a particular ecosystem, there's a die-off from stress. It's almost like the species rebalances to the natural resources available to it by, you know, some members of the group dying. And you see that as well when they've, you know, there's been the studies, I think they're fairly famous studies of deer populations on islands in Maine where they become overpopulated, but then the excess population dies off to rebalance. You know, there's, and it may be that cats are going through that kind of a process when there's too many of them. You know, they kind of stress out and they can't survive.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question that, a lot of, you know, the cats that we are attempting to adore and to pamper and spoil are completely miserable because they find themselves in these confined spaces with not that much to do. And they, for lack of a better word, they kind of lose their marbles, some of them, and they exhibit these behaviors which, you know, cause them to be taken into the doctor. Veterinarians can't figure out what's wrong with them. And basically, you know, it, a lot of this misery has to do with the fact that these animals are not suited in any thought out way for domestic life. They just happen to have striken up an alliance with humanity. And the consequences of that in the 21st century are that there are these shut-ins, and really cats are suited to having huge spaces to run around in and lots of things to kill and animals to mate with and all the things that make them cats, we in our attempt to adore them have taken away from them.
Well, and also, as you mentioned, I thought, you know, one of the, I think there was the example of the guy who rescued cats that were really seriously ill and put them in essentially a very simple environment. They were in cages, you know, they were no longer in this hyper-stimulated environment that humans put them in. And they actually almost miraculously got better simply by being in a better, you know, in a less fanciful environment. I thought that was really profound.
Yeah, and it seemed like the main variable that was eliminated in those experiments with where these cats who were very troubled and had lots of behavioral problems were taken away from their fancy living rooms and their loving owners and sequestered in these tiny little cages, and then they were given this very strict schedule of now is playtime, now is feeding time, everything happens by the clock. The main variable that was taken away in those situations was, you know, the owner.
Right.
And, you know, these people who tried to love their cat as best they could really were making their cat ill by doing things like feeding the cat at different times or having a party or having a baby or doing all of these things that humans just tend to predictably do, which are just sort of part of the way we live our lives. But we don't understand the impact on these very sensitive, very delicate, exquisite hunters that we've chosen to pack the planet with that are not actually the pets of convenience that we've always sort of told ourselves that they are. They, you know, they can survive in our houses, but that doesn't mean that they are thriving psychologically there. And so there's a little bit of a discussion about how the best and most sort of appropriate way to cohabitate with a cat is to feed your entire household to the cat and just basically go and live in one little closet. You know, not that serious, but that the cat needs its own room and the cat needs lots of different bathrooms and it needs you to make sure that you don't talk above a certain number of decimals because your voice hurts its ears and you have to crank up your thermostat to some sort of tropical temperature and all of these things because even though these animals being survivors are surviving, they're in a state of sort of latent distress in our household, even though we love them so.
Yeah, I thought some of that you documented, some of that behavior is amazingly strange from an outsider's point of view. And also, I thought it was, you were very good about, you know, this idea that, and I think we kind of know that if we're been around cats, not a lot, if we're not really cat lovers, you know that cats, you know, they're not reliable in the sense that you think you know what your communication is with this animal, and it really isn't what you think. You know, that purring is not necessarily, I mean, this idea that the cats are kind of training their owners to get what they want, I found kind of interesting that, you know, it's sort of, we think of us as being the ones who are domesticating the animal and getting a feedback system going. And what really is happening with cats is the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. Cats are, one of the interesting things about cats is that they're very much asocial animals. It's the exceptional cat, but really it's only lions that are social animals. And even lions don't really cooperate in ways that we associate with members of the dog family. Like wolves are very much, you know, they have hierarchy systems and stuff like that. Cats are almost always completely solitary animals, and they don't have a rich communicative repertoire. They have, you know, they have sort of life or death, fight or flight kind of expressions. But other than that, cats aren't evolved to communicate you know, have sort of deep communion with other creatures. And so when they find themselves locked into a house with us, unable to go outside, either because the owner is concerned about the wildlife outside, or more likely, according to studies, is concerned about the welfare of the beloved cat, the cat realizes that it's got to figure out some sort of way to get its messages across to people. And so, yeah, they do seem to embark on this this unique system of training their individual owners and kind of conditioning the owners in a Pavlovian manner to recognize when the cat's needs need to be met. And it's an extraordinary example of how, again, cats are extremely adaptable and can survive in places where they, which are the opposite of the environment to which they evolve. But yeah, there's consequences to that. And, you know, sometimes humans don't get the message, or sometimes, you know, cats are born with innate personalities also, and the more reclusive cats may be more stressed out in certain circumstances. So it's really kind of an interesting dynamic that we set up for ourselves, and very new, because cats have been affiliated with us for 10,000 years and living in our settlements and eating our trash and things like that. But this intimate relationship that we have with these animals is really a recent thing, and we're just starting to understand it.
So we can't go without talking at all about the internet meme of cats, or the memeization of cats. And, you know, you could talk endlessly about it, but I think, you know, you did talk about it in the book, but I'm wondering, you know, in your kind of analysis of the cat phenomenon, how do you categorize the way cats have become so powerful as symbols, as we call them, memes, for communicating and enjoying on the web? I just, you know, it is so powerful and so bizarre. It's not something, again, that I don't track down these things the way some people do. I'm not constantly watching YouTube videos of cats, but I know that they're out there, and it's hard to imagine, you know, it's just, we know in modern life, it's just a phenomenon. You know, what is it all about?
Well, it's very bizarre. And I think that, you know, there are a couple ways to think about it. One is that cat owners and cat people in general have been for decades without a social outlet to talk about their cats and to share in ways that, you know, at the dog park, you see people using their cats as their dogs as sort of avatars to connect with other people and to chat and to socialize. There's some argument that that could be happening online and that this is just a need that's never been met before. But I think there's also other ways where the pattern that we see play out on the internet is just kind of the same thing that we've seen playing out for the last 10,000 years as cats have spread from a tiny little region of the Middle East and invading ecosystem after ecosystem to take over pretty much the whole world. And we see that same thing play out online now. And I think part of it has to do with the way cats behave, and they are, asocial ambush predators, which means that they have this very sudden pounce-oriented ambush style of moving around. They move in these very jerky, funny kinds of ways that are sort of very well captured on video and through memes. And they also are asocial. Like we talked about, they're not animals that communicate, which means that they can sort of exist in cyberspace in their purest form. Like if you look at a dog on the computer, you're not really experiencing the dog in the way that you're meant to experience the dog, because dogs and owners are very much attuned to each other and can communicate on the same channels and receive bursts of oxytocin when they look into each other's eyes. None of that stuff happens with cats. So you're able to have the full feline experience just by looking at your computer. It doesn't matter whether you're sitting next to the cat or if you're 10,000 miles away from the cat, you're still witnessing the essence of the cat. And then the other thing that I think is interesting is that cats, because of their predatory style, they have certain facial characteristics. They have these eyes that are planted right in the middle of their heads, and they have small noses because they're not animals that track. They're sit and wait predators. They don't track track prey over long distances like dogs. They use their eyes. And then they have these short, rounded faces and powerful jaws because, again, they explode out of hiding spots to kill things. And this combination of features, these eyes centrally located in the head, the small nose, and the short face give them a very human look. And cats, even though they don't act like humans, look like humans very much. And that gives rise to this impulse that we see to caption these inscrutable cat faces, which are very deadpan, which makes them kind of funny. But, the emotions that we assign to them when we look at them online are not emotions that cats actually are familiar with. Cats are, in a different emotional universe, essentially. So I think those are a few of the things that are in play, that the biology of the cat really does kind of propel it online the way it's propelled itself in other ecosystems on the planet Earth.
Well, I think that is actually the perfect description of how cats have operated. And I think, whether you like, I think your book is suited for people who love cats and for people like me who are just curious and don't fully understand or grasp the attraction. I think you did a great job with this book. And I really appreciate having the chance to talk to you about it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're going to have a good time as you get to talk to people about it around the world who will, you probably get criticized too by some people who feel you haven't given cats their due, which would be strange, but I wouldn't be surprised, from some of those people who are the most dedicated to these animals. But I think it's, you've done a great job with this book.
So, thank you so much.
Thanks, Abby Tucker, for talking to me today. This is David Wilk. I've been talking to Abby about The Lion in the Living Room. This is Writer's Cast.